Hi, everybody. This is Howard. Welcome to the fifth session of our Thibault book study. We're on page 41, the last part of Surrender versus Compliance in Therapy with special reference to alcoholism. And what has happened so far is that Thibault has presented surrender as, you know, he's looked at surrender as leading to acceptance, which he didn't before. And he talks a lot about acceptance. And then he talks a lot about compliance, which is this kind of opposite idea. It's half-hearted acceptance. He says that the two are incompatible and that the one can block the other, that compliance can block your progress by preventing true acceptance or true surrender. So we've read all that, and now what we've got is on this heading, we've got he's going to talk about how all this stuff applies directly to alcoholics, so compliance and alcoholism. Do we have a order to go around, Suzanne?
Yes, I'm going to start.
Okay.
Great. Thanks, Howard. Compliance and alcoholism. It's now possible to link compliance with the problem of alcoholism and also to the theory of surrender. The link between alcoholism and compliance has already been shown in the alcoholic's repeated vows that he would never take another drink. Vows that go by the board because of the inner inability to do more than comply. The presence of a strong vein of unconscious compliance in the alcoholic can be demonstrated in other ways. Alcoholics are a notably pleasant and agreeable group with a marked tendency to say yes when approached directly. They claim they want to be well-liked, hence their willingness to promote anything. Yet, and here, the other side of the compliance reaction is manifest. They balk at the showdown and are ever likely to renege on their original promises. As another illustration, they are keen to go to a show, buy tickets in advance, and then, on the night of the performance, wish they had never had the idea. Characteristically, one man always calls up at the last moment for a date, knowing that if he had made the engagement in advance, his present wish would later appear as a must that he had to live up to. He, like so many of his kind, has to do things on the spur of the moment. Otherwise, the contrary half gets into action and the project is opposed and squashed. A favorite remark, "Let's have some fun," must mean immediately the desire evaporates if there is any planning to be done. Often, alcoholics go downtown merely looking for fun with not a thought of a drink on their minds. In fact, quite compliant to the need for sobriety. When they find the fun, however, the chances are that they will be in trouble before the night is over. Undoubtedly, the initial restlessness that simulated the need for some fun had its origin in the early rumblings of the non-compliant elements. Much of the apparent dual personality of alcoholics becomes understandable if their behavior is seen in the light of conflicting trends. The next point, the relationship between compliance and surrender, has already been intimated in the remark that compliance blocks the capacity to surrender. The inability to surrender may seem a small loss until the matter is studied more thoughtfully. Any comments?
Are we going to stop here, or did you want me to start reading, Suzanne?
I want to just ask if anybody has any comments. Okay, so then I guess we'll continue on. Karen, it's all yours.
Okay, after an act of surrender, the individual reports a sense of unity, of ended struggles, of no longer divided inner counsel. He knows the meaning of inner wholeness, and what is more, he knows from immediate experience the feeling of being wholehearted about anything. He recognizes for the first time how insincere his previous protestations actually were. If he is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, he travels around to meetings proclaiming the need for honesty, usually at the start of his pilgrimage, with a certain amount of surprise and wonder in his voice. Quite frankly, before he was able to embrace the program, he had no idea he was a liar, dishonest in his thoughts. But now that AA is making sense, that is, he is accepting AA wholeheartedly and without reservations, he sees that previously he had never truly accepted anything. The AA speaker does not follow through to state that, formally, all he had been doing was complying. But if he asked, he nods his head in vigorous assent, saying, "That's exactly what I was doing." A more articulate individual, after a little thought, added, "You know, when I think back on it, that was all I knew how to do. I suppose that was the way it was with everybody. I could not conceive of really giving up. The best I could do was comply, which meant I never really wanted to quit drinking down inside. I can see it all now, but I certainly couldn't then." Obviously, the speaker is reporting the loss of his compliant tendencies, occurring, let it be noted, when he gave up, surrendered, and thus was able wholeheartedly to follow the AA program. Let it further be noted that this new honesty arises automatically, spontaneously. The individual does not have the slightest inkling that this development is in prospect. It represents a deep, unconscious shift in attitude, and one certainly for the better.
Yeah, so he's describing the start of the positive phase. I think he's also describing somebody who's embarked on the rest of the steps. I didn't truly get how dishonest I was until I started doing step four. I understood that I needed to be honest, and I had been dishonest, but I didn't really get to it, until step four. But so I think these guys are actually doing more than just step one, which has been Tebow's focus. So I think he kind of merges all that in here. But the important thing is he's talking about the positive phase and why surrender leads to that. You know, and the psychic division goes away from his point of view, psychiatric point of view. The argument inside saying, I want to drink, I can't drink, I want to drink, I can't drink, you know, goes away. That struggle goes away, and we cease fighting everybody and every thing eventually. But, I mean, you know, heading towards that.
Hi, it's Suzanne. I thought it was interesting, too, in what I read, where he says that he's talking about alcoholics are agreeable, but yet mm-hmm. if they make a to go to a show or want to do something, it's kind of at the last minute. And also there was something else that he said, which was on page 42, sometimes people will go out to do something kind of innocently, and then they end up going out to drink. But the first part of it, of wanting to do something and being, wanting to have a good time and wanting to be social and things like that, I think a lot of alcoholics have social anxiety issues, and that's what kind of causes this. And then what Karen read, I think, is when we start doing four steps and when we start seeing how delusional our mind is, I think, at least for me, it's like I was able to have, understand my patterns more or begin to see what my patterns were. I wasn't really aware exactly what was going on. And with, especially with the fourth step, I was able to, start kind of putting the dots together, and that was really helpful for me at least. And And then the other thing, too, when we want to go out, it reminds me of that part in the Big Book when Jim, who's got the automobile agency that he lost, and then he's going into the bar to have lunch when he's kind of mad at his he gets into it a little earlier with the man who currently owns his agency, and you know, there's all these kind of little pieces, but the big thing is that we never know when the spiritual malady is going to come up, and we have to really be careful about going to places that are, you know, slippery for us. And even, you know, opening the door and going outside can be slippery for us too sometimes. So thanks. Anybody else like to share, or we can move
well,
on?
Well, as far as honesty goes, and the first step, of course, that's a huge leap in honesty, difficult to take. You know, often takes ruin and the nearness of death to actually get people to do it. You know, you can't make it happen, but sometimes calamity can. So that's an honesty. So, you know, honesty's coming in from the beginning. But what he describes, it just struck me as, you know, somebody had maybe moved through step one, two, and three, or maybe we're on the edge of three or something like that, where the pink cloud is active. And since I got this idea, and I think that Thibault is talking about step one, I think he's missing a lot of the process there. That's all.
Hi, this is Karen. I couldn't agree more, Howard. That was awesome. And thank you, Suzanne, for your share. This is just like, I'm reading this as the part that I just read. I was getting like kind of emotional reading that because I experienced that. And we were talking earlier before we started this meeting tonight that, you know, I read all of this material early on in my first couple weeks, you know, coming back in after you know, being back out there for 6 years. And I'm reading it now with a totally different set of eyes because I have experienced the awakening that this process promises us if we follow the directions. And so everything looks different. And all I can think about as we're reading this is what Carl Jung shared with Roland Hazard, that you know, the huge emotional displacements and rearrangements and the new ideas replacing the old ideas. What a relief that was for me. And surrender, what follows surrender, that positive stuff, is the relief that, oh my gosh, I am the problem. And it's okay that I'm the problem. And I mean, this is what I'm hearing as we're reading this, and I'm so grateful that we have this. So thank you.
Anybody else? And we'll go on to Terry. Would you like to read?
It is now possible to see the usurping dog in the manger role of compliance. As long as compliance is functioning, there is halfway but never total surrender. But the halfway surrender and acceptance, serving as it does to quell the fighting, temporarily deceives both the individual and the onlooker, neither of whom is able to detect the unconscious compliance and the reaction of apparent yielding. It is only when surrender occurs that compliance is knocked out of the picture. Freeing the individual for a series of wholehearted responses, including, in the alcoholic, his acceptance of his illness and of his need to do something constructive about it. Enough has been said, it would seem, to show the significance and the importance of understanding the relationship between compliance and the ability to surrender and accept. They are in complete opposition. As long as the former control reactions, there can be no wholehearted acceptance, only the half-hearted kind, which is admittedly not sufficient. Results of real value can only come about when the compliant reactions have been successfully dissipated.
Anybody want to share? Okay. Nate,
that's one
like-
of his bottom lines, right? It's actually the bottom line of the paper.
So shall we continue on and with Stephanie?
No easy road to understanding. Some will ask how this can be brought about. The answer, insofar as I have been able to formulate it, is long, involved, and rather hazy. Experience shows that through psychotherapy, the dominance of compliance over the unconscious can slowly be superseded, and that through the AA experience, compliance can be temporarily and sometimes permanently blotted out. There does not appear to be any easy road to real understanding of this problem. The preceding materials can now be summed up. It was pointed out that in an earlier article on the phenomenon of surrender, the tie of surrender to acceptance had not been sufficiently stressed. It was also pointed out that the concept of acceptance is freely talked about, but rarely, if ever, made an object of study. Some observations regarding the nature of acceptance were reported and was shown to contain two possible reactions, which we called wholehearted acceptance and half-hearted. It was then demonstrated how half-heartedness and compliance were closely allied. The nature of compliance was next discussed, and lastly, the antipathetic relationship between compliance on the one hand and surrender and acceptance on the other. This is a long and rather circuitous route to the point of this paper, excuse me, namely, that surrender is essential to wholehearted acceptance, and that unconscious compliance, which is a halfway surrender, can be a vital block to genuine surrender. It was then pointed out that alcoholics frequently show marked unconscious compliant trends, which not only help to explain some puzzling aspects of their behavior, but also account for their frequent inability to respond meaningfully to treatment. Since the presence of these trends has been more clearly recognized, the response of many patients to therapy has been considerably more satisfactory. These considerations have been presented in the hope that others also may find that a recognition of the process of surrender, acceptance, and compliance can be a source of help in tackling the alcoholic psychotherapeutically.
Anybody want to share?
Yeah, this is Howard. I think at the beginning of this No Easy Road to Understanding section, he says that, how do you bring this about? And it's kind of hazy to him. And it's long involved and rather hazy experience. I don't think he understands the process, again. Through psychotherapy, he's trying, he says, to slowly supersede. And he notes that through the AA experience, compliance can be temporarily and sometimes permanently blotted out. So he knows AA works, but he says there's no easy road to real understanding of this problem. So he's admitting that he just basically can't explain in scientific terms why it works. And, and then the rest is just the coda, summarizing again.
Thank you. Bob, would you like to continue?
Well, can I say something about this paper?
Sure. Go right ahead.
This is considered, and in my opinion also, is the most important paper in the collection. This is the paper where he goes into detail about what he thinks the ego of the alcoholic is composed of. He's talked before about that the ego having to be what becomes humbled. It'll say that right in a minute. But now he's going to look at that in more detail, and it's it's damning. You know, it's like, you look at that, I look at that, and it's, oh my God. A lot of it, for me, there was a lot of enlightenment reading this. So that's all.
And the paper is The Ego Factors in Surrender and Alcoholism.
Righto.
It's all yours, Bob.
Suzanne, this is Karen. Bob had to jump off the call.
Oh, okay. So let's see. Lee, are you here? Okay, then let's... Howard, would you like to start us?
Lee is on.
Oh, he is. Okay.
Yeah.
Hey, Suzanne, I'm on, and I'm listening to you guys, but I'm in the middle of work, so I won't be finished for about another 2 hours, but I'm listening to you guys.
Okay. We'll have Howard continue then.
Hi, Lee. Okay, so I know you don't have to respond. You're doing something else. All right. So the ego factors in surrender and alcoholism. In the past 15 years, my understanding of the nature of alcoholism as a disease has been influenced largely by insight into the mechanisms at work in the Alcoholics Anonymous process. Some years ago, I stated that AA, to succeed, must induce a surrender on the part of the individual. More recently, I discussed the idea of compliance acting as a barrier to that real acceptance that a surrender produces. On this occasion, I propose to extend my observations by discussing A, what factors in the individual must surrender, and B, how the surrender reaction changes the inner psychic picture. The first question, what factors in the individual must surrender, received passing attention in the article on compliance. There, relative to the difficulty of surrender, I noted that the presence of an apparently unconquerable ego became evident. It was this ego that had to become humble. The first part of this present communication will be devoted to an elaboration of the nature of this ego factor. And now he's going to go into his definition. This paragraph has his definition of what ego is, and then he's going to try to explain to his colleagues why it's not the technical term. So, pass.
The use of the word ego involves the possibility of confusion of meaning. For a time, therefore, I considered a substitute term. That idea was set aside because despite possible misinterpretation, the word ego is current in everyday language in exactly the sense in which it will be employed in this discussion. The expression, he has an inflated ego, is self-explanatory. It invokes the picture of a pompous, self-important, strutting individual whose inferiorities are marked by a surface assurance. Such a person appears thick-skinned, insensitive, nearly impervious to the existence of others, a completely self-centered individual who plows unthinkingly through life, intent on gathering onto himself all the comforts and satisfactions available. Is generally considered the epitome of selfishness and therefore the matter rests. This popular view of ego, while it may not have scientific foundation as one decided value, it possesses a meaning and can convey a concept that the average person can grasp. This concept of the inflated ego recognizes the common ancestor of a whole series of traits, namely, that they are all manifestations of an underlying feeling state in which personal considerations are first and foremost. Anybody want to share?
That is so aligned with the book, it's scary, you know. Epitome of selfishness, right? And just that list of traits, you know, thick-skinned, insensitive, nearly impervious to the existence of others. Sometimes I was thin-skinned too, but I was certainly impervious to the existence of others. a completely self-centered individual who plows unthinkingly through life, intent on gathering unto himself all the comforts and satisfactions available. This is, you know, it's just, it's in with more about alcoholism. I mean, just fits to a T. And I love this. I love that. So, pass.
Yeah, there's some really good character defects listed there. Okay, Karen, would you like to continue? Anybody else want to share?
Yeah, this is Carrie. I immediately thought about the actor who wants to run the whole show. Like, it just, I had to laugh when you were reading that because it so describes, you know, us running the show and who we are as alcoholics. So I immediately thought about 60 to 63. So, thanks.
Hi, this is Karen. I had the same reaction, Terry. And you know, this, what's really, really funny about all of this is that Howard posted a description, an ego description, for us to look at. I don't know if everybody had a chance to look at it, because what's really, really something about this is that this describes, like, when you hear people talking about, you know, the devil on your shoulder, the beast, like some speakers talk about how this alcoholism is like a beast. Well, this is the description of it right here, the ogre, because I always considered myself such an ogre when in my cups, so to speak. And what's really ironic about this is that, you know, Freud's description of the ego, Harry Thibault decided not to go with that, and he went with this because this is what we can understand, you know, the whole egomaniacal thing. But, ego was actually the good guy. So it's really, like, it's worth looking at if you want to look at. Howard did a great job. Thank you so much, Howard, for posting stuff for us to look at because it's really, you know, brings it home in this description. And but when you read, like, where it comes from, it's like, wow. You know, he hits the nail on the head because this is what this disease brings us to, what being, you know, fear-driven, delusional thinkers brings us to, and that the alcoholic war cry of where's mine when we first come around, too. You know, so, and when ego is at its finest. So, thanks. You want me to continue on reading if no one else wants to share, Suzanne?
Please.
Okay, so we're at the existence of this ego?
Yes.
Okay. The existence of this ego has long been recognized, but a difficulty in terminology still remains. Part of the difficulty arises from the use of the word ego in psychiatric and psychological circles to designate those elements of the psyche that are supposed to rule psychic life. Freud divided mental life into three major subdivisions, the id, the ego, and the superego. The first, he stated, contains the feeling of life on a deep instinctual level. The third is occupied by the conscience, whose function is to put brakes on the impulses arising within the id. The ego should act as mediator between the demands of the id and the restraints of the superego, which might be overzealous and bigoted. Freud's own research was concerned mainly with the activities of the id and the superego. The void he left with respect to the ego is one that his followers are endeavoring to fill, but as yet with no generally accepted conclusions. Ego, two definitions. The word ego, however, has been preempted by the psychiatrists and psychologists, although they do not always agree among themselves about the meaning to be attached to it. The resulting confusion is the more lamentable because almost everyone, layman or scientist, would agree on the concept of the inflated ego. It would be helpful if other terms were found for the ego concepts about which there are differing views.
Anybody want to share?
Well, yeah, so that's just a dry technical discussion of interest to psychiatry, you know. He's telling his colleagues where, you know, he's trying to explain to them in the context of Freudian psychic model what ego isn't. The ego he's talking about isn't. It isn't that. So he's just technical explanation.
Carrie, would you like to continue? Anybody else want to share?
This is Cameron. I like this description, and I like the way this goes into it to understand, you know, basically how it appears when you read it this way and you read Freud's description is that we have a hijacked superego that doesn't do its job. So instead of, you know, putting the brakes on things, when ego's trying to be the buffer between the external world and the id, and the superego comes along and is the brakes, it's the conscience, and when it's hijacked, you know, for people like us, it agrees with the id. So it's a real crazy thing. So it's like nothing's ever enough. And I think that's where, you know, Dr. Thibault has ego, you know, like being the big bully. So, I mean, that's how it appears to me. Thanks.
Thank you. Anybody else? Okay, Terry, it's all yours.
The solution for this dilemma will be to indicate with a capital E, the big ego, and without a capital to identify the personality aspect that Freud had in mind when he placed ego between id and superego. With this disposition of the problem of terminology, it is now possible to consider the first issue, namely the ego factor in the alcoholic that, through surrender, become humble. The concept of the enlarged ego, as noted previously, is available to common observation. Those who do not recognize it in themselves can always see it in some member of their family or among friends and acquaintances, not to mention patients. Everyone knows egotistical people and has a perfectly clear idea of what the word means. Besides, egotistical, in the series of the words mentioned earlier, adjectives that help to round out the portrait of the egotistical person are prideful, arrogant, pushing, dominating, attention-seeking, aggressive, opinionated, headstrong, stubborn, determined, and impatient.
Anybody want to share? And Stephanie, will you continue, please?
All these terms are inadequate, however, because they describe only surface features without conveying any feeling of the inner essence from which the ego springs. Unless some appreciation for the source of the ego is gained, the dynamic import is lost, and the term may seem merely a form of name-calling. It is easy to say someone has a big ego without awareness of what is really happening in the deep layers of that person's mind without perception of the ego, nor is it a matter of intellect. The need here is to lay hold of the inner feeling elements upon which the activity of the ego rests. Only when these elements become clear can the fundamental basis of the ego also be clarified. It is convenient for the exposition of this inner functioning to reverse the usual sequence and to present a conclusion in advance of the evidence on which it is based. This is briefly that the ego is made up of the persisting elements in the adult psyche of the original nature of the child. Certain aspects of the infant psyche may be usefully examined. There are three factors that should receive mention. The first is, as Freud observed in his priceless phrase, His Majesty the Baby, that the infant is born ruler of all he surveys. He comes from the nirvana of the womb, where he usually the sole occupant, and he clings to that omnipotence with an innocence yet determination that baffles parent after parent. The second, stemming directly from the monarch within, is that the infant tolerates frustration poorly and lets the world know it readily. The third significant aspect of the child's original psyche is its tendency to do everything in a hurry. Observe youngsters on the beach. They run rather than walk. Observe them coming on a visit. The younger ones tear from the car while their elder siblings adopt a more leisurely pace. The three-year-olds, and more so the twos, cannot engage in play requiring long periods of concentration. Whatever they are doing must be done quickly. As the same children age, they gradually become able to stick to one activity for longer times. Did I keep going? I lost my...
Let's stop for a second.
Paragraph.
Yeah, okay. That paragraph has so much in it. Would you like to share? Or?
Only that this is my favorite part so far. I mean, I can totally understand and relate to His Majesty the baby. And pretty much poor frustration tolerance, doing everything in a rush, clinging on to omnipotence, those are all things that really describe me to a T. That's all.
Thank you. Anybody else?
Yeah. Well, this is Howard. I just want to say me too. Reading this description is uncomfortable sometimes.
This is Suzanne, and I love the fact that he so clearly takes apart the, these three factors. And I love the fact that he really goes into, like, where the ego, I think, really originates, which is as the baby. And I also really like the fact that he is very clear in telling us that the infant tolerates frustration poorly, and we know that the alcoholic does too, or any addict has a lot of trouble with patience. And the third thing with being in a hurry, it's like I constantly hear people in the program talk about, I can't focus, I'm rushing, rushing from one thing, I'm rushing to another thing, blah, blah, blah. And I think this is so great that he just really lays it out. Thanks. Anybody else? Okay, then, Howard, will you please continue?
Okay, am I muted?
Yes, you're unmuted.
Good. I asked if I... Yeah, good. All right, so... thus at the start of life?
Thus at the... Yeah, exactly.
Thus at the start of life, the psyche assumes its own omnipotence, cannot accept frustrations, and functions at a tempo allegretto with a good deal of staccato and vivace thrown in. These are all musical terms for accelerated and irregular rhythms, and it's at the high end of the energy spectrum in orchestral music. Now, the question is, if the infantile psyche persists into adult life, how will its presence be manifested? In general, when infantile traits continue into adulthood, the person is spoken of as immature, a label often applied with little comprehension of the reason for its accuracy. It is necessary to link these traits from the original psyche with immaturity and at the same time show how they affect the adult psyche. If this is done, not only will the correctness of the appellation immature be apparent, but moreover, a feeling for the nature of the unconscious underpinnings of the ego will have been created. Okay, so this was the stopping point, and we have plenty of time. So want to go to the next heading, which is inability to accept frustration? Or was that the original one? No.
Oh, yeah, I'm fine with that. But I just want to talk about this for a minute.
Sure.
And what I wanted to say is that when he's talking about maturity here, for me, this is where in the program I have to be humble, because if I'm not humble at looking at my king baby self, if I'm not humble looking at my frustration level, if I'm not humble looking at my rushing around and hurrying, then I am going into immaturity. And I have been immature. It's like that's a big piece for me, at least, of my recovery, is I'm digging and looking at and getting more information on where I've acted like, you know, this baby, big baby. And if I am arrogant and unable to let that mask, if I'm constantly keeping the mask on, I'm not going to really get anywhere. And that, to me, is what recovery is about. It's about me taking the risk to take off that mask and to be able to say, this is what I'm doing, this is me, and to be able to kind of move forward with it. But I'm constantly, even in my 10th step, needing to be humble and risking, having to risk being humble, doing new things, doing things that aren't necessarily easy for me, doing things that I have a lot of fear about. So I really enjoy this part of the reading. Thanks. Anybody else?
Well, yeah, this is the ego that has to be smashed. Mm-hmm. This is the ego that resists surrender. And, you know, and it's stemming from, well, this is the ego that produces the selfishness of the alcoholic. The selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our problems. That's the ego that's producing that. And, you know, I look at all of these elements and I see that I, you know, that they're at work in my psyche even now. You know, I have to, you know, knocking the ego down once is not enough. It gets back on its feet. So I have to be aware of these tendencies in my thinking. And if I start feeling resentful towards someone, it's a classic case in AA, right? Usually there's a, and I don't say always, there's a there's an ego problem. It's like you dissed me, or I'm not going to get what I think I deserve, et cetera, you know, all the things that we worry about. So, yeah, this is a great in-depth look at, I'm not sure, you know, you can talk about them in various ways. Is that me, or are we cool?
It stopped, whatever it was.
Oh, good. Okay. Anyway, you can make good discussion on how that ego is structured, but Thibaut has given us a nice, really nice outline of the personality elements that he's finding are resisting the act of surrender, which is required in order to move ahead. So one other thing that an infantile ego is stubborn. So, okay, that's all.
Yeah, this is Karen. Howard, thanks. That was awesome. You know, the whole thing of it is, like, looking at this in depth, is that this is the ego that we alcoholics bring into adulthood, and it's a baby. It's an immature, underdeveloped, id-driven ego, and so it can't be anything but selfish and self-centered because that's all it knows. And so this is why I think, you know, from what we're reading and stuff, this is why the psychiatric community hasn't had any luck, you know, helping us the way that they want to, because we understand each other because we're all bringing this into this, and we're all coming. So it's almost like, it almost feels like a maturation process for me in recovery, like a growing up. I mean, I'm still who I am, and when I bite off more than I can chew and I run around like a chicken with its head cut off, the frustration level is unbearable. But I see it coming now because of this work that we do. And it's like I see me coming, and I can hit the pause button which is something that everything in us is manual, that in a, say, a normal adult is automatic. It's not for us. I mean, this is how, but this description of this, you know, the king baby and the queen baby, those pamphlets that are out there are really helpful, because to understand that this is what I brought into adulthood, and this is where the crux of the issue is. So thanks.
Well, that's great. Great comments. Yeah, I feel like I grew up a lot the first time around with AA. I mean, I had no moral sense. I got a sense of ethical, you know, that some things are right and some things are wrong. I had no sense of that. And I had, you know, pointed my fingers at everybody. I was, you know, I had temper tantrums, you know, all of this stuff, this infantile, immature personality that I had. And I faced a lot of truth about myself, and that's a maturation process, right? You know, that letting, tearing down that ego so you can see what's really going on. You know, you have to. For me, I had to accept reality, right? And in order to grow up, but it was coupled also with this turning towards opening my mind to the idea that the world could be moral. So anyway, that's all about me. But I loved your comments. I agree with those. It's good stuff.
Hi, this is Stephanie. I think, too, in reading this, this is like such good news, because the ego can show itself drunk or sober, absent or not abstinent, you know, it's really, really good news, because for me, these ego factors show themselves even when I put down whatever substance it is that I'm in recovery around. So I really like this, because to me this is where the hope is. That
anybody else want to share?
I'd like to just take a share on this too. It was a great read, and thanks for everyone's comments. And just to go back a little bit about the compliance and the surrender to go with the ego, you know, compliance, you know, I always think about compliance like we don't have to go to any length, and surrender, we go to any length. And you know, when I think of compliance, I think of, you know, on page 58 where it says that some of these we balked, we thought we could find an easier, softer way. And when I think of surrender, I think of if you've decided what you want, what we have, and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. And with the ego, I look at, you know, the first three steps, you know, it's all about, you know, me running the show and, you know, having some compliance, but not complete surrender until I get to three. And then when I do 4 through 7, that's when I see some big chunk of truth about myself, and I become humble, you know, because I know now my truth. And it just really helps me to take off the mask and be authentic, because before that, before 4, you know, I was always somebody else. And with 4 through 7, I get to be who God always had me to be. And it's just really, it's good to see how the ego can creep in even today, you know, if I'm not surrendered in 3. So thanks for letting me share.
Anybody else? So Terry, would you like to continue on, or I can continue?
Yeah, recognizing immaturity. 2 steps can aid in recognizing the relationship between immaturity and the continuance of the infantile element. The first is by an act of imagination to set these original traits into an adult unconscious. The validity of these procedures is found upon modern knowledge of the nature of the forces operating the unconscious of people of mature age. The second step is to estimate the effect that the prolongation of these infantile qualities will have upon the adult individual. This attempt should not strain the imagination severely. Take, for instance, the third of the qualities common to the original psychic state, namely the tendencies to act hurriedly. If that tendency prevails in the unconsciousness, what must the result be? The individual will certainly do everything in a hurry. He will think fast, talk fast, and live fast, or he will spend an ordinary amount of time and energy holding in his fast driving prolixities in check.
Anybody want to share? Then we can keep on going. Stephanie, would you like to continue?
I had a hard time unmuted. Where do I start?
Often
the net result. Page 52.
Often the net result will be an oscillation between periods of speeding ahead followed by periods during which the direction of the force is reversed, the brakes, superego, being applied in equally vigorous fashion. The parallel of this in the behavior of the alcoholic will not be lost on those who have had experience with this class of patients. Let us take the same trait of doing everything in a hurry and apply it to the word immature. Few will deny that jumping at conclusions, doing things as speedily as possible, give evidence of immaturity. It is youth that drives fast, thinks fast, feels fast, moves fast, acts hastily in most situations. There can be little question that one of the hallmarks of the immature is a proneness to be under inner pressure for accomplishment. Big plans, big schemes, big hopes abound, unfortunately not matched by an ability to produce. But the effect upon the adult of the persisting infantile quality to do everything in less than sufficient time can now be seen in a clearer light. The adult trait is surely a survival from the original psyche of the infant. The two other surviving qualities of the infantile psyche similarly contribute to the picture of immaturity and also indirectly help to clarify the nature of the ego with a capital E. The first of these, the feeling of omnipotence, when carried over into adult life, affects the individual in ways easily anticipated. Omnipotence is, of course, associated with royalty, if not divinity. The unconscious result of the persistence of this trait is that its bearer harbors a belief of his own special role and his own exceptional rights. Such a person finds it well nigh impossible to function happily on an ordinary level. Mm-hmm. Obsessed with divine afflatus, the thought of operating in the lowly and humble areas of life is most distressing to him. The very idea that such a place is all one is capable of occupying is in itself a blow to the ego, which reacts with a sense of inferiority at its failure to fill a more distinguished position. Moreover, any success becomes merely ego fodder, boosting the individual's rating of himself to increasingly unrealistic proportions as the king's side eagerly drinks in this evidence of special worth.
Anybody want to share?
Well, that's potent stuff. I'm not sure about the speed. You know, the way I think is I'm impatient and I don't like to be stopped. He talks about stopping later. I'm not always in a hurry. Am I natural without any, you know, program applied? But I do jump from idea to idea. So I recognize that in me, but this omnipotence I very much recognize as, you know, in my character, my belief that I am entitled to more than anyone else. Or I don't even think about anyone else, right? It's just this is mine. And whether it's more or less is just not considered. But define afflatus means, I would think, an heir or a, I should have done this before, latus. A divine creative impulse or inspiration. Okay, so. So, yeah, I got that. Okay, that's all.
I like his sense of humor when he says omnipotence is, of course, associated with royalty, if not divinity. I thought that was funny. And I'm sorry I got kind of bumped off the call, but I was happy to hear that you just kind of proceeded.
I've done that twice now, so I'm glad I'm back.
Okay, so anybody else want to share? If not, Howard, would you like to continue?
This is Karen. Great stuff, everybody. I love this sharing that we have going on. You know, when it says, moreover, any success becomes merely ego fodder, boosting the individual's rating of himself to increasingly unrealistic proportions as the kingside eagerly drinks in the evidence of special worth. All right, Bill's story, did not my, you know, fellows in my, they give me a medal, you know what I mean? Like when he first comes back and he's, you know, all about going to be a great leader, because didn't they tell me how wonderful? I mean, all somebody had to tell me was that they liked my haircut, and I was, you know, Princess Diana, you know, in my head. So this is what we bring, again, this is what we bring into adulthood, is, you know, and then, you know, nothing, see that other side of us, the other side to the king, the other thing sitting on our shoulder is that we've got superego telling ego nothing's ever good enough, nothing. It's not enough. It's got to be more than this. And our war cry is more, more, more. Give me more. And that's like, you know, the rest of this. That's the flip side of this. You know, there's one side that you know, the omnipotence, and that divine afflatus makes me think of, you know, God complex. The whole God complex, the whole thing where I have this giant metal key and I just put it on your back and wind you up and make you go everywhere I want you to go. So that like, this is just a great way of seeing where we came from, you know, what we brought into this and why we need the work that we do together to be able to live differently. So thanks.
Anybody else? I didn't realize it's time to kind of wrap up. Any last-minute comments?
Yeah, this is Stephanie. I just wanted to make a comment about the rushing, because I'm really prone to rush and do things in a hurry, and I think it's sort of like this idea of, you know, I'm trying to wrest satisfaction and happiness out of the world. Like, it's me, more me, and not taking into consideration that, you know, other people are also trying to get to their work and their places of business on time, that the traffic isn't there because the world is conspiring against me. I totally, totally relate to this last passage. Thanks.
We're stopping. This is Howard. We're stopping at a kind of a critical point in the middle of an important description. So maybe tomorrow we can sort of refresh and maybe stop back a couple of paragraphs and read forward, because the context will be helpful in what we read subsequently.
Sounds great. Anybody else? Any final comments? If not, we can say the Serenity Prayer together.
God.
Grant me the serenity.
Grant me serenity.
To accept things I cannot change.
The
courage
to change
things
I can.
And the wisdom to know the difference.